This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is bringing food, Christian education, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to the thousands of displaced children flooding into Lebanon's refugee camps. Help the Christian response to terrorism today with a gift of $98. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Welcome, everybody. Great to have you with us again. I had to laugh recently when I was witnessing a children's sermon where the pastor asked a group of little kids what they wanted to be when they grew up. All of the little girls, I kid you not, said they wanted to be princesses. And a few of the little boys answered, and they said they wanted to be either a soldier or a fireman. And I thought to myself, it really doesn't matter how much we hear that boys and girls are only different because our culture forces gender stereotypes on them. The fact of the matter is boys and girls are different and God made them that way. And we know that. And this is especially important when we look at how little boys really are under siege in so many ways. It's why my next guest is urging parents and teachers and adults alike to let boys be boys. It's the name of the new ebook from Trail Life USA CEO Mark Hancock. And he's here with us now to share some winning strategies for leaders of boys. And Mark, it's great to have you with us. How are you?
I'm doing great, Janet. Thanks for having me on.
Well, you are so welcome. I'm glad you're addressing this, and I would imagine you're pretty much convinced, as am I, that God made boys and girls differently, and that's okay, and that's not something we're forcing on them. It's something God designed them to be.
Well, it feels somewhat politically incorrect in this culture, but it's a thoroughly defensible position that boys and girls are different. There's so many different sciences that point to that, and it used to, of course, be an accepted fact in our culture. And it's a shame that we have to address it. But boys need some help, and they need for us as adults to stand up and point out that boys and girls are different, and they need different strategies and help them grow.
Oh, they sure do. What would you say about this seemingly declared war on boyhood that you've talked about the culture embracing? What are some of your concerns in that regard? What do you see in the culture right now that really is making things harder for little boys to grow up to be the men that God designed them to be?
Well, there's a number of things, and they all seem to point towards making it more difficult for boys to be successful. One is this the cultural talk right now around toxic masculinity, which seems to discount manhood and discounts boys being, you know, raised into good, strong men. That certainly is a piece of it. And then also, you know, in the 90s, we started this great initiative to help girls in the areas of science and technology and math because they had been falling behind. And we put that whole focus on developing girls, and we designed our classrooms and our teaching styles and our textbooks and everything around teaching girls in order to help them catch up in that area. But we forgot that the girls, or we didn't pay attention to the fact that the girls were excelling in some other areas, in language and in interaction with other kids, and some social interaction skills, and the boys were lacking there. And so we didn't pay attention to those things for the boys. We just focused on the girls. The girls have made great strides, but they've kind of left the boys in the dust. Girls are now leading in every academic category that there is, and boys are two times more likely to receive special education, three times more likely to be diagnosed with ADHD. Hmm. You know, women now outnumber men in colleges and at the undergraduate level, more master's degrees going to women, more doctoral degrees going to women. We've just kind of left the boys a little bit in the dust.
Well, we have, and long term, that's bad for the girls, isn't it? We don't need boys to be falling behind. We need boys to be strong men when they grow up.
We really do, and again, that sounds like it's politically incorrect, but the way that God made men and women, the strengths that they have, we need to acknowledge those and accept the strengths that women have and accept the strengths that men have, and encourage those strengths and build on those strengths rather than denying that there are differences.
Oh, for sure. When you mention toxic masculinity, I get a little bit irked when I hear that phrase because it's thrown around a lot. What do you think they're really talking about when they say toxic masculinity, as if there's something wrong with being masculine? And how does that have an effect on boys and on young men when they hear that being masculine is toxic?
Well, I mean, you can only imagine if you're being told that and you're seeing that in your culture. And of course, we have years and years of the fathers being the buffoons on television. That's part of our culture, and it's showing, it's rearing its ugly head now in boys. And so we're getting out of them exactly the behavior that we expect in a lot of cases. Now, of course, there's toxic men, and there are bad men. But, bad men don't happen automatically. Bad men happen because we're not developing strong boys, strong, confident, winning boys. And we've lost our focus on developing them into good, strong, masculine men rather than teaching them to honor women and to respect women. The current movement is that women are fine on their own. They're strong on their own. They don't need your help. And it's just creating this dynamic that doesn't allow men to be the strong warrior type leader in the household, leader in the society that I believe God designed them to be.
Right. Well, hopefully I can speak for all clear thinking women and say, we need you. We need men. We need boys. It's just a ridiculous thing on its face. We were made to complement one another. Well, the strategy that you talk about at the outset in your book is to embrace the scientific evidence of physical and psychological differences between girls and boys. What would be, you touched on that a little bit when you were talking about classrooms, for example, and how boys and girls will act differently or have different needs in the classroom. But what about some of the physical differences between boys and girls that are important for us to focus on if we're going to solve the problem?
Well, I focus on these things because they're undeniable, and you can't argue about these things. They're just facts. Things like that boys have more rods than cones in their eyes. Now, that's a physical difference. So what does that mean? It means that they can see distance and motion more clearly. But shapes and colors are more challenging. That's why when you sit a boy down and tell him to color or to be careful in his handwriting or working close to his face to draw or to write or copy things, it's less engaging for boys, while objects in motion that are at a distance can distract boys. Now, what does that look like? That looks like a boy who can't pay attention. So that looks like a boy who needs an ADHD diagnosis when it's just simply his eyes operating differently. Girls can hear 10 times more. Sometimes better than boys can. So a soft-spoken teacher might not be able to hold that boy's attention. So what does that look like? It looks like a boy who's not paying attention, and so he's going to be diagnosed ADHD. You know, and we've heard for years that our brains are wired different. We understand we have a left brain and a right brain. Well, the truth is that's only true for males. Girls can process verbally on both sides of their brain. So in a classroom where there's one person standing up front talking to them, and they need to see that person, not be distracted by that person, be able to hear that person clearly, but also process what's being said. And girls just have an advantage there. So that classroom is built for girls to be able to process on both sides of the brain, and boys are just having trouble making those connections that girls are able to make easily. So like in Trail Life USA, we give specific strategies and certainly any kind of classroom where you're dealing with boys, things that you can do to help boys engage more clearly. And one big thing is to separate boys from girls, put them in their own environment. We're seeing great success in schools that are going to single-gender schools. Incredible. Booker T. Washington High School in Memphis raised its graduation rate from 53 to 90.5% after they converted to boys-only and girls-only classroom.
Wow.
So once you have that set up, then you can change your strategy in that classroom. You can set the class up different, even just physically. Plenty of volume, plenty of movement, plenty of voice fluctuation, hand motions, engaging the boys visually, engaging them auditorily, letting them move so that more of their brain is active. The more of the brain that is active and when they're learning, the more they're able to process and learn those things. So just those physical differences, just to acknowledge that, not even to go into any of the other things that may be psychological or people may argue as being a social construct. But rather than cones in your eyes are not a social construct, that
right.
is the design of God.
Right.
The way that the brain works is not a social construct. The way that the ears process sound is not a social construct. That's the way that they're built, and they're just built different.
Well, they really are. And like you say in the book, rather than teaching concepts from a worksheet, for a boy you could make a poster, make a drawing, use large floor demonstrations, those sorts of things. And that makes sense because the end result in the classroom is you're trying to reach both boys and girls and teach them effectively. And if you're using a methodology that is more geared toward girls, of course it makes sense that you would inadvertently perhaps leave the boys behind. And I think some of those suggestions are really, really important. We're talking with Trail Life USA CEO Mark Hancock. His book is called Let Boys Be Boys. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to their health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? We're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you'll access health care, so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $199 per month for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. That's libertyhealthshare.org. Regain control over your healthcare costs. Together, we're changing healthcare for good. That number again, 855-585-4237 or visit libertyhealthshare.org. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. It's the worst humanitarian crisis in our lifetime. 2 million refugees are in the tiny country of Lebanon, and most of these are kids with only a surviving mother living in disease-ridden tent settlements. They are the innocent victims of war. But you can help. Call 866-485-9187. Your gift of $98 will help rescue 18 of these children and bring them to the Heart for Lebanon Hope Centers, where they can learn, be fed, and most importantly, begin a relationship with Jesus Christ. Rescue a classroom for Christ before someone else captures them for evil. Call 866-485-9187. That's 866-485-9187. Our goal is to take care of 61 classroom days. Will you please help me sponsor one, two, or even five classrooms right now? Call 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Welcome back to Janet Mefford Today. Let boys be boys. How hard is it? I agree. And it's the name of a new ebook from Trail Life USA CEO Mark Hancock, who is joining us to share some winning strategies for leaders of boys. We were talking a little bit before the break, Mark, about the differences, physical differences between boys and girls and how that plays out in the classroom. Now we have a really obnoxious, I think, thing that's come up in our culture. And you know what I'm going to talk about, and that is you have this whole push from the radical homosexual agenda, which says you have to be more and more gender neutral. And it's wrong to separate boys and girls because essentially we're not different. And then what do you do with transgender kids and this sort of thing? How does that complicate things when you're trying to get back to brass tacks and trying to get to the basics and help boys as God created them to be? And then you're faced with criticism. Well, you can't really separate boys and girls because then it's not gender neutral and you're reinforcing stereotypes. How do you get around that kind of stuff?
Well, when you start with the question that you're asking is how do you make this happen? How do you help boys without going against this thing? That really exposes the real issue is that in society for some time now we've stopped paying attention to kids about what's really best for them.
Yeah.
When you look at abortion, that didn't help kids. When you look at divorce laws being made so easy, that didn't help kids. When you look at the same-sex marriage, that doesn't help kids. And all these things we weren't paying attention to kids. And so it's difficult to answer that question because you're not going to be able to say these things without pushing up against this really strong social movement that's so contrary to biology, to science, to culturally, to what it is we understand. Every engaged parent and every experienced teacher knows that boys and girls are different.
Right.
We just know that. I like to share the story of boys and girls who are given pads and pen and a candle and a book of matches and told to go out into the night and write deeply about themselves, about what it is they thought. Well, the girls went out and they did exactly that. They came back with pages of nice, beautifully written things on what it is that they thought about themselves and who they were. Well, boys threw their pads in a pile and lit them on fire and had a great bonfire. Really enjoyed themselves.
Of course they did.
Yeah, now we laugh about that, and our response is what yours is. Of course they did. Now, if you reverse the genders in that story, you say, boy, some girls went out in the woods, and they were supposed to write this thing up, and instead they started this bonfire and danced around it. You say, wow, there's something wrong with those girls. We would know that there was something wrong with them. And that's intuitive. That's not a social construct. We know that there's that boys and girls are different, and that just doesn't square up with us. With us. And so it's hard to answer your question saying how are we going to deal with a culture that's saying the opposite, because they're just going to say it. But we have to know, we just have to know that we're right.
Yeah.
And like I said, any engaged parent knows if they got a boy and a girl, and this, you may say it's a generality. I don't think it's a generality, but I'm sure that there are some exceptions. There are some girls who like to do boy things, and there are some boys who like to do quote unquote girl things. But for the most part, we know that boys and girls are different. So we have to stay focused on that understanding that God created them that way. And it's beautiful that he did, with the strengths that they have and the way they complement one another. And we just have to stay true to that. And that's why in Trail Life USA, we are boy-focused. We reinforce that we are Christ-centered and we are boy-focused. So if that's what we begin at, this contrary culture isn't going to be able to work that out of us, because we just hold those to be truths that are just at our core. If we stop being Christ-centered, there would be no need for us to exist, because there's other organizations out there that don't honor Christ.
Yes.
And if we stop saying we're just focused on boys, we wouldn't need to exist, because there's organizations out there, 108-year-old organizations, that are suddenly saying they're going to accept girls as members. And so there's no reason for us to exist. We're sold out on those concepts, because we think that boys need this type of thing. So it's tough to answer your question, because I don't know that we pay attention to that contrary message. We just stay the course, and we're seeing a lot of success because of it.
Well, that's really wise to do that. Another strategy that I want to talk about is something you emphasize, which is the need for boys to take risks and to compete. Mm-hmm. Again, we're in the era of participation trophies. This is not necessarily a good thing for boys, is it?
No, it hasn't been. It's been a bad thing. It's had such a negative effect on their development. I like to say that what it's done, that everybody wins philosophy, has created generations of unproductive narcissists.
Yes.
They're unproductive because we haven't expected anything from them, and they're narcissists because they haven't failed. And boys, just as they are, automatically think better of themselves. They think that they're able to do things that they really can't do. And so their first encounter with the real world, once they get out of our school systems, which are telling them that they can do anything, they get a trophy for just showing up, they get out in the real world, they are really slammed when they find out that somebody expects them to do something in exchange for a paycheck, or do something in exchange for a grade or an award or something like that. And so they encounter that, and that's why we have more men living at home than we've ever had since the census was begun in 1960, because these men, what they call the failure to launch syndrome, they get, because they've been carried along and being given trophies and told that they were really okay, they encounter the real world and find out, I can't keep a job. They're just not letting me come in and give me a paycheck. I actually have to perform. And they haven't had a chance to succeed, and they haven't had a chance to fail. And it's produce this kind of grouping of unproductive men, which just feeds into the lie that men aren't worth much and they don't have much to offer. It's just like a self-fulfilling self-defeating cycle.
Well, it is. It's kind of funny. I was reading in a website recently, everybody knows the phrase helicopter parents, and I was reading that there is this new phenomenon called lawnmower parents. And lawnmower parents, according to this article, are the parents who want to get every obstacle out of their kid's way so he can succeed. And that kind of ties into what you're talking about, that kids need to fail, especially boys, they need to fail in small ways so they learn how to handle life, right? I mean, if you're taking all of your kid's obstacles out of the way so he never fails, this is exactly what you're going to get when that boy becomes a man. He will not know how to handle life in the way that he ought to when he gets to that stage.
Exactly. And that just feeds that mentality that they're owed something, and that they should automatically get a paycheck and automatically get a car and a home and what it is that they need just by showing up. And of course, they're discovering in huge numbers that that just isn't true.
Right.
And it puts a challenge on the workplace and to figure out a way to motivate, particularly these young men who think that, who've been told their whole lives that they just get a trophy for showing up.
That's it. You talk about boys basically asking three questions when they have social interaction. They ask, who's with me? Who's in charge? What's our mission? Why is it important for adults to understand that? And how do we take those three questions in mind and take those into account when we are raising boys?
That's a great question. And where that comes from is really looking at when you look across our society and you say, who is really successful at engaging boys and keeping them involved and engaged and active and moving forward and focused on a goal? And you say, well, who's doing the best is gangs. Gangs are really good at that. And so they answer these three questions really clearly. Who's with me? They identify real quickly who's part of that group. And they have a uniform or some way that they identify themselves through signs or whatever. Who's in charge? It's real clear there's a hierarchy in that setup there that lets them know who it is at the charge. Boys love knowing who's in charge. They love knowing the boundaries. A boy who's in a classroom is going to test those boundaries. You know, you have the situation with a substitute teacher and the challenges they can have in a room full of boys. Well, the boys are just trying to figure out what's the new rule here. Who's the top dog, quote unquote?
Right.
Who's in charge? And then the third thing, what's our mission? If we don't set a clear mission for boys, and gangs are great at setting a clear mission, if we don't set a clear mission, they'll set one of their own, and it won't look like we intended. It will be something else. That just like I said, here, boys, here's a mission. Here's your pads and your pens and your paper. Go out and write this stuff. They'll figure out something else to do if they don't have somebody right with them who's with them and who's in charge and clearly setting out what it is that they need to do. So boys are tremendously creative and can accomplish a lot in a little time. But if you can define for them who's with them, and we do that through trail life by setting them up in patrols, you know, where they're working together and they're in uniform and they have a patrol name and there's a cohesiveness to who's in charge. There's a hierarchical structure in there and over them all is an adult somewhere. And what's our mission? We give them very clear missions to accomplish. And that gives boys such confidence in that area. When those three questions are answered for them, that is when they are at their best. They're not getting off track. They're not making trouble. They're not doing something we didn't intend for them to. They are focused, and they can do so well. We see that in gangs, and we see that in our military, the amount that they can produce and the things that they can accomplish when these three questions are answered.
Oh, that's really important. And finally, and I know we don't have a lot of time left, but your third strategy that you mentioned in your book is physical movement. The fact that you need to get guys out there, they can't just sit quietly all the time and have uninterrupted eye contact. You have to get them outside, right?
Yeah. Well, boys know that intuitively. If you sit a boy down on his desk, what do boys do if you tell them to sit still? They fidget.
Yes.
And so they know intuitively that they just know this, that they've got to move. Because, you know, the research shows us they need an hour of moderate or vigorous physical activity a day. Well, they're not getting that, particularly not in schools. And we've cut recess back farther and farther and farther. And even recess is so controlled that it doesn't really get them the aerobic activity that they need for their brains to be engaged. So, and in fact, our industrialized learning environments punish them for doing what they need to do to learn best. They need to move to learn best. So when we tell them to sit still and be quiet, they're not at their best for learning. John Rady, who's an associate professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, says, movement activates all the brain cells kids are using to learn. It wakes up the brain. And we need to wake up the brains of these young men.
Absolutely. Well, Let Boys Be Boys is the name of the ebook. You can check out traillifeusa.com. Mark Hancock with us. Mark, so good to have you here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Janet. God bless you.
God bless you, too. Thank you for being with us. We'll be right back. This Janet Meffer Today podcast is brought to you by Heart for Lebanon. Heart for Lebanon is bringing food, Christian education, and the gospel of Jesus Christ to the thousands of displaced children flooding into Lebanon's refugee camps. Help the Christian response to terrorism today with a gift of $98. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com. Janet Mefford today. Thank you so much for being with us. Hey, I just want to thank you guys for calling 866-485-9187. We have been telling you about the wonderful ministry of Heart for Lebanon. Such a wonderful missionary force is being created in the Middle East right now, and I'm really, really excited about it. I think it's fantastic to see the gospel going out to these families that are in great, great need, living in the tent cities of Lebanon. This is not a part of the world a lot of us have been to, but it is amazing what the Lord is doing. Millions of refugees are living there right now. They are the innocent victims of the violence over in that part of the world. But the Lord is at work through the Hope Centers that Heart for Lebanon runs over there. And these children who come and don't have sometimes even one parent left, their fathers have been killed perhaps, and this is true of a lot of them. They are ripe for radicalization from Islamic terrorists who are there to recruit these children. They're ripe for sex trafficking, all kinds of horrors. They don't get much to eat. They don't have an education. So in come these Christians, and at these Hope Centers, these children get food to eat. They are able to receive a Christian education, and so many of them are coming to Jesus Christ. And it isn't just these little kids, folks. It's also their parents. And I just wish I could be there to tell you more up close, but I want to turn to Camille Melke, who is the founder of Heart for Lebanon, who's going to share a little bit more about the ministry.
So in the beginning, we wanted to reach out to 100 Lebanese families in the south of Lebanon. Thousands of families were cared for that year. And then we thought, okay, let's turn our attention now to the Iraqi refugees late in 2008. Today, Heart for Lebanon is reaching 1,075 Iraqi families. At any given month, Heart for Lebanon is visiting homes of the Iraqi refugees, doing Bible studies with the women and the men, having monthly gatherings for the families, distributing basic food and hygiene supplies. Early in 2011, when the crisis began in Syria, Heart for Lebanon said, we need to start also paying attention to this crisis that is beginning to evolve in our neighboring nation called Syria. Hundreds of thousands of Syrian refugees started coming to the nation of Lebanon. Today, Lebanon is considered the largest host of refugees per capita. Heart for Lebanon today is providing care for 2,800 Syrian refugee family in every given month. Not only that we provide basic food and hygiene supplies, but Heart for Lebanon has also three non-formal educational programs. We have 260 students who are studying in a regular academic program every day, Monday through Friday. We also have a Hope on Wheels. This is our theater truck that travels within the refugee tent settlements. Pull out that truck there. It's like Christmas time, or it's like ice cream truck comes to town, you know, and kids just migrate around this truck and expecting time of fun, time of activities, sing-along, dramas, kids, storytelling, all that we could do in order to restore a smile back to the faces of these children. Heart for Lebanon has medical teams that on periodical schedule, they go everywhere that we are serving in Lebanon, trying to do basic medical assessments and try to provide medication and support for the families we serve. We also have a health awareness team that travels in order to raise awareness about health hazards, about hygiene awareness, things that would help prevent disease spreading. There are multiple ministries that we have at Heart for Lebanon, reaching out to the hundreds of thousands of refugees in our country.
Well, it's a wonderful outreach, and I'm so excited to tell you about Heart for Lebanon. And I know many of you have given to Heart for Lebanon in the past. The need is still great. If you can give a gift of $22, you'll be rescuing 4 children. If you can give a gift of $98, you'll be rescuing 18 children. Will you please help us help these kids who will go home one day and help reach their nations for Jesus Christ? Here's the number to call. 866-485-9187. 866-485-9187. There is also a banner to click at janetmefford.com. So we encourage you to pray about what you can give. We would really, really appreciate it. We are excited to be helping this wonderful ministry do something that really is not done by many people, and there is an overwhelming need. So if you can give, I'll give that number one more time. It is 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com. And just a quick reminder, we never solicit donations from you at all for Janet Mefford Today. But on occasion, I will ask you to please be generous with a ministry that means a lot to us. So if you have ever considered donating to the show itself and supporting our ministry, this is how you can be of help. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com. Thank you so much. All right, I want to dive into the news a little bit. Of course, Nikki Haley is leaving her UN ambassador post after really a very fruitful 2 years. So much has happened at the UN. We know a few weeks ago, the president got up there before the General Assembly at the UN and talked about principled realism and asserted the American vision once more of everything that we have historically stood for, peace through strength. And all sorts of things have gone on, as we know, in the last couple of years. We've had the North Korean situation tempered, the hostages released. We've had the corrupt dictatorship in Iran dealt with. We've had, you know, sanctions imposed and, you know, on and on and on, the Iran deal. And also President Trump and Nikki Haley being a big part of this, really standing for the American way of life. And that's what we needed all along. So we'll see who replaces her, but I think she's done a tremendous job. Now, switching gears and switching sides of the ideological spectrum, I have to play this cut because Hillary Clinton, of course, weighed in on President Trump's apology on behalf of the American people to Supreme Court Justice Brett Kavanaugh. I just thought this was a really interesting clip. Listen to cut one.
What was done last night in the White House was a political rally. It further undermined the image and integrity of the court. And that troubles me greatly. It saddens me because our judicial system has been viewed as one of the main pillars of our constitutional government. So I don't know how people are going to react to it. I think given our divides, it will pretty much fall predictably between those who are for and those who are against. But the president's been true to form. He has insulted, attacked, demeaned women throughout the campaign, really for many years leading up to the campaign. And he's continued to do that inside the White House.
Okay, isn't this the same woman who called us all a basket of deplorables? She stood up and called us all a bunch of homophobes and xenophobes and racists and sexists and pigs and phobiaphobes and all the rest. And you can just summarize the whole thing by calling us a basket of deplorables. But it's President Trump who's demeaning people. It's President Trump who's all about a political rally. Hillary Clinton is never political. I mean, why are they going to this woman? And if you want to talk about inappropriate remarks, why don't you just accept your loss gracefully, as I keep saying, and encourage her to go spend time with your grandkids? You're never going to get this time back in your life, Hillary. You're now in your waning golden years, and you should use your time wisely. Spend it with your grandkids. You know, politics isn't everything. Well, at least it is not everything to most of us. But listen to this. CNN announced that Bill and Hillary are going on tour. Did you hear about this? They will be headlining a series of live events together, billed an evening with the Clintons. Oh, man. Well, at least it would be a good opportunity for the Me Too movement to show up and protest, right? Because they believe women. They believe women. That's their mantra. Every woman who makes a claim of any type about sexual abuse or sexual misconduct must be believed. And so far, they really haven't shown a whole lot of interest on the Democratic side for Juanita Broderick or Kathleen Willey or any of these many other women who have come forward in alleged misconduct against the former president of the United States, who happens to be married to Hillary Clinton. So I think it's really a good opportunity for women who want to continue to keep the Me Too movement going to really stand up against this kind of alleged misconduct that is lobbed at somebody who has had many, many women come forward. I mean, they thought it was fine with Kavanaugh, even though there was no corroborating evidence. I don't know. Maybe it will be time. But I'll tell you, when we come back, I want to discuss who's really politicizing everything. And I bet you can guess who I'm going to talk about. We'll come back on Janet Mefford Today after this. Hi, this is Janet. It's hard to imagine what it would be like to be forced from your home and made to live in a dirty tent city in a foreign country. And yet that's exactly what has happened to millions of people who have fled their own lands to find refuge in the country of Lebanon. Now consider this. Most of these refugees are children. The tragedy is that Lebanon is overburdened and unable to keep pace with the refugee crisis. So there are 2 million refugees in Lebanon today. The children don't go to school. They don't have enough to eat. They're targeted by Islamic radicals for recruitment. These are children who need hope, practical help, and the gospel of Jesus Christ. It's why we here at Janet Mefford Today are so honored to partner with the great ministry, Heart for Lebanon. Through their Hope Centers, Heart for Lebanon gives these children food, a Christian education, and exposure to the gospel for the very first time. When you call 866-485-9187 with a gift of $22, you'll help rescue 4 of these children and give them an entire day of care and the gospel in Heart for Lebanon's Hope Center. For a gift of $98, you can help an entire classroom full of children. Just call 866-485-9187, or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Here's the incredible part. Not only are these little ones coming to know the Lord, but so are their parents. What the Lord is doing in Lebanon is incredible. And once these families are able to move back home, just think about the impact they'll make on their home countries for Jesus Christ. This is an incredible window of opportunity that we have to make an eternal difference in the lives of these little ones and their families. So please call now, 866-485-9187. Again, with a gift of $22, you'll help rescue 4 children. And for $98, you can rescue an entire classroom. Call now, 866-485-9187. That's 866-485-9187. There's also a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Please pray and give whatever you can while the Lord works in the lives of these children. 866-485-9187 or janetmefford.com. We're back on Janet Mefford Today. Let me get this straight now. Hillary Clinton was interviewed about what President Trump did at that ceremonial swearing-in of Justice Brett Kavanaugh, in which he apologized appropriately to the justice and his family for the way he had been treated over the past couple of weeks and how he was put through the ringer and a political hit job. And Hillary Clinton was interviewed by CNN, and she said it was a political rally, what Trump did, adding it further undermined the image and integrity of the court. Because that's what the left is all about, the image and the integrity of the court. Well, I wonder if Hillary is aware that there are some online ads popping up nowadays from Planned Parenthood. And this particular ad I'm looking at right now has a big picture of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And the ad copy says this: it's RBG's 25th anniversary. Protect women's rights in her honor. Give now, Planned Parenthood. Oh, yes, we don't want to politicize the court. We want to maintain the independence and the integrity of the court. Sure. And by the way, speaking of Ruth Bader Ginsburg, do you remember what she did 2 years back? She gave that interview to the New York Times, and it was quite controversial. She ended up having to apologize after this. But she told the Times in an interview that she couldn't imagine what the country would be with Donald Trump as our president. And she said, for the country, it could be 4 years. For the court, it could be, I don't even want to contemplate that. As her late husband used to say, now it's time for us to move to New Zealand. Now, of course, Donald Trump didn't take that sitting down. He got mad about it, and he did an interview with the New York Times and said it was highly inappropriate that a United States Supreme Court judge gets involved in a political campaign. He called on her to resign at the time, in fact, and it was incredibly inappropriate. I don't know why it is that leftist judges can do that kind of thing, but everybody else just has to keep a muzzle on it. Now, this is what Jonathan Turley had to say. He is the George Washington University law professor, weighing in at the time and reacting to Ginsburg's comments on Fox. Listen to Cut 4.
Well, they were thoughtless, but more importantly, I think they were facially unethical. Canon 5 of the Judicial Code says that judges cannot make statements of this kind in opposition to political candidates. Now, the way these justices get around that is they claim that those rules of ethics only apply to lesser jurists. And this may come as a surprise to most Americans, but the 9 justices claim that the rules of ethics cannot be enforced against them, that they look at those rules voluntarily and decide how they will apply to themselves. And as you might imagine, the result is that they often are the judges of their own case and find themselves entirely innocent.
Wow, nice system if you can find yourself in the middle of one like that. Shouldn't you keep the ethics anyway because you have ethics? At least people who do have ethics hopefully would say, sure, maybe technically the ethics only apply to lesser jurists, but being that we are the Supreme Court, we ought to have the highest ethics of any jurists, and perhaps we should stay out of politics. Well, but again, we had Kagan and Ginsburg performing so-called same-sex marriages and then going on to refuse to recuse themselves from the Obergefell decision. How is that ethical? Or Kagan refusing to recuse herself from the Obamacare case, the first Obamacare case, when she had been the Solicitor General who was weighing in on potential answers to challenges to Obamacare. Why didn't she recuse herself? Where are the ethics? Perhaps we should have stronger ethics responsibilities and lay them out for the Supreme Court and make them obey them. Because honestly, you don't, to me, it's unconscionable that you say we don't have to abide by ethical rules. We're the Supreme Court. Well, then you should have the highest ethics. So who's really politicizing the court? An interesting piece at the Weekly Standard back in July of 2016, around the time that Ginsburg got into trouble for her remarks to the New York Times, delved into the politicization of everything. And Jeff Bergner is his name. He said this. Part and parcel of a clear and consistent pattern of the left's increasing politicization of everything is this Ginsburg incident, and the chief instigator of this behavior has been President Obama. In the modern era, presidents and ex-presidents once showed a degree of political restraint. President Obama has blasted through these restraints and spoken freely as a partisan rather than as a president. An early example is the president's criticism of the Citizens United case in his 2010 State of the Union address. Oh yeah, I remember this one really well. You probably do too. It's one thing for a president to advance a view about the role of money in politics. It is quite another to launch a broadside about a specific court decision in front of Supreme Court justices captive in the front row of a nationally televised speech, complete with cheering partisans standing all around. And this, of course, resulted in a classic media deflection, namely criticism of Alito's silent, and accurate, by the way, response. This was certainly no sign of presidential respect for the court's independence. Now, President Obama's behavior was of a piece with his comments on the unfolding IRS scandal in 2014. Here was a genuine abuse of government power, replete with lying and stonewalling and the wanton destruction of public documents. It would be one thing if the president were to opine about a congressional investigation into the IRS scandal. It's quite another to do so when the president's Justice Department had launched its own investigation of the IRS. Yeah, that was pretty inappropriate, wasn't it? And he also chose to opine about the legal affairs of individual Americans before the facts were even established. You know, Harvard professor Henry Gates and Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown. And he was all in, even though the facts eventually showed that he was on the wrong side. But what about the Islamic terrorist attacks in places like Orlando and Fort Hood and San Bernardino? Oh, in that case, don't jump to conclusions. In fact, we know what the motivations were in those crimes because the perpetrators stated them openly and honestly. And President Obama just kept telling people, no, the motives are complex. They're unclear. We don't need to know until we have a full investigation, except when you get the results of the investigations, it's not like it changes his mind. And here's where it really gets interesting. As this writer says, Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign provided numerous occasions for the president to interfere with his own administration's legal proceedings. Remember when President Obama stated categorically that there was no national security threat that resulted from Hillary Clinton's private email server? At the same time, his own FBI was investigating that very question? And not content with this, the president announced he would make a joint presidential campaign appearance with Hillary Clinton at the very moment the FBI was completing its investigation and referring the matter to President Obama's attorney general. The stunning novelty of this was a bit overshadowed when the president's attorney general held a highly unusual private one-on-one meeting with the husband of the FBI's investigatory target, a man who was himself in the middle of the activity under investigation. All of this is simply unprecedented. And speaking of unprecedented, President Obama's frequent rhetorical attacks against Donald Trump are in a class by themselves, different from any recent president's behavior during the campaign to choose a successor. Sitting presidents can and have made clear their preference of a successor. There's nothing new about that. But it has invariably been done in a restrained way, often accentuating the positive qualities of the preferred successor. Never has there been a case of a president repeatedly bad-mouthing the opponent of his preferred successor. Now, that is exactly what Obama did. For a long time, it's been clear that the four Democratic-appointed Supreme Court justices generally vote in lockstep on political issues of importance to the president. When there are public calls for bipartisanship on the court, this is code that one or more Republican-appointed judges should vote with their Democratic-appointed colleagues. And they often do, as in the case of Obamacare and college affirmative action. But it never goes the other way, does it? It never means the opposite. Though Democratic-appointed judges have displayed a clear ideological discipline, until Justice Ginsburg's comments, there was at least a polite fiction about the court's independence from partisan politics. Justice Ginsburg has exposed the game. She has followed the lead of President Obama in destroying the partisan restraint that used to mark our most important institutions. And there it is. Hillary Clinton can talk all she wants about President Trump turning something into a political rally when it was inappropriate to do so. But in fact, I think it was absolutely key that the President of the United States put his foot down and say, this was wrong, what was done to this man. He didn't go and call out Cory Booker. He didn't call out Kamala Harris. He didn't call out Dianne Feinstein and insult them and throw names or anything like that. What is wrong with apologizing to a man who was put through the ringer? And at the end of it, there was no there there. What does it tell you about that ideological side of the aisle that they think an apology to somebody who was put through something like that is nothing more than a political rally? Especially given their own hypocrisy and the own background that they have in so many ways just a short time ago. It isn't President Trump who is politicizing the Supreme Court. The left has managed to do that all on its own long before President Trump took the oath of office. We're out of time. We thank you so much for being with us. God bless you. We'll see you next time. Our website, as always, is janetmefford.com. God bless.